Coachmaster Auto Body. Big box store body shops have come to our area. They contract with as many insurance companies as possible. They provide discounts for these referrals. This allows the insurance company to dictate the parts and repair process to ensure the lowest cost of repairs as possible. This is not in your best interest for your expensive investments. At Coachmaster, we work for our customer, not the insurance company. We have no obligation to cut parts prices or use inferior parts. We follow strict manufacturer repair guidelines. It's your choice and your choice alone where you choose to have your vehicle repaired. Coachmaster was established in Reading in 1969 and doing quality repairs in Reading for over 55 years. Coachmaster has proven to be your best choice for collision repair. And yes, it is your choice. Our friendly service and quality repairs will have you referring all your friends and family. And remember, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Remember Coachmaster on East Side Road. Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
There's an internal tension in democracy. It's the two principles that make up democracy. On the one hand, is equality, and on the other hand, freedom. And he believed that there would always be intention.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Khalil Habib, Associate Professor of Politics and Allison and Dorothy Rouse Professor in Politics at Hillsdale College. And today we talk in depth with Dr. Habib about Alexis de Tocqueville, his life, his work, his thoughts on America. Dr. Habib, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Always enjoy our conversations. We take a deep dive today into democracy in America and Tocqueville. Who was Alexis de Tocqueville? Why did he come over here to America?
Well, Alexis de Tocqueville was the Catholic French diplomat. He was born in 1805. Unfortunately, lived a very short life. He died in 1859. And he was commissioned to come to the United States to ostensibly study our prison system, and which he did do. And he did write a book, a very short book on the prison system. But he was struck immediately by the democratic experiment in the United States. And so he ended up writing this massive two-volume work on what's called Democracy in America. The first volume came out in 1831, and then the second in 1835, and then 1856, rather. And it's been a classic ever since.
Somehow prisons in America doesn't have the same ring to it as Democracy in America does.
Right, exactly. But I should say one other thing about him, though, that makes him quite unique. He was a practicing politician. He was the former minister for Europe and Foreign Affairs of France, and he was an aristocrat. Doesn't necessarily mean he sided with the aristocracy. In fact, he's got some criticisms of them, and he does praise democracy. Mm-hmm. But your listeners should know that he's unique in one very important regard. Around the time Tocqueville's writing, you had a lot of philosophers who were essentially professors, which usually means their philosophy tends to be a little bit abstract and mm-hmm. academic. The advantage that Tocqueville has, having his feet firmly planted in politics, is Democracy in America is very lucid, very clear. It doesn't have any jargon or abstraction, and can be essentially read by any educated person. Whereas, you know, one would have to struggle, you know, even with a PhD in philosophy to understand, say, someone like Immanuel Kant or Hegel. And so that is an important feature, I think, of his character.
What was happening here in America around the time that Tocqueville was observing and then writing about his experiences?
So when Tocqueville arrives, he arrives during Andrew Jackson's presidency, and the West was still being settled, and there was an expansion westward. One of the chief points that he thinks is happening in America that's really unique to America is he notes to his French audience that the Puritans in New England were establishing centers of political participation, local participation. And he said it was the first time in Western history that you had two things coming together that had been diametrically opposed, especially in France, and that is Christianity and liberty. And that was the most distinctive feature of what was happening at the time. The other feature, which is sad, and it's one of the tragic moments in American history, is that there was slavery being practiced mm-hmm. in the southern states. And it was a kind of slavery that Tocqueville said was the worst. No slavery can ever be justified. but the American Southerners instead practiced it on the basis of race, as opposed to, say, you know, ancient forms of slavery, where it was just the victor got the spoils and you became a slave. And it was never based on race or any notion of racial superiority. And so he thought that that marked a very unique point in American history. But he also recognized, thankfully, that the practice of slavery in the United States was against the very principles of the American founding. And so he actually predicted the Civil War and predicted that the South would lose because they were just simply too foreign. Their principles were completely at odds with the American founding. And so those were the features that were really unique at the time of his travels in the United States.
How accurate was his observations and his interpretations of what he saw? Can we consider Tocqueville a faithful narrator of his time?
He's pretty remarkable. I mean, I think one of the reasons why this book has become such a classic and it is studied in a variety of different departments is because of its accuracy. A lot of it is sociological. He's always interested in how the social conditions in the United States shape the mores, a French word that he uses for moral character or morals and sentiments in the United States. I want your listeners, though, to be aware that there is some controversy about whether or not he was completely accurate. One of the things that some of his critics point out, and critics on the right, by the way, not just simply on the left, mm-hmm. is that he doesn't make any real serious mention of the Declaration of Independence. And so the argument goes that how accurate can it be if one of the most distinctive features of the United States, the Declaration of Independence and its relationship to the Constitution, isn't even mentioned by Tocqueville. Now, to be fair to him, I think often we forget that the book was actually never written for Americans. It was written for a French audience and an audience that had experimented with revolution, but did so in a very abstract way that led to a terrible French Revolution that resulted in nothing but despotism. So I think he was a little bit wary of, I think, bringing up our notions of natural rights. He does believe in rights, but I think he kind of leaves them in the background.
What did Tocqueville himself think about democracy? Was he in line with the way that our founders would have been thinking about democracy?
He often associates the Federalist Party. There was a Federalist and the Anti-Federalist Party in the United States, and he often associates the Federalists, whom he describes as America's great geniuses and statesmen. And so to that extent, I think he aligns pretty well with the American founders' vision of what our regime is essentially established to promote. His view on democracy is kind of complicated because, as I said in the outro, at the intro of our radio show, he was an aristocrat. Mm-hmm. And again, that doesn't mean he blindly followed aristocracy. He did think democracy had merits. He does believe, for example, that your merit should confer your fate and your future and not your birth. And an aristocracy, as you well know, you're often born into certain privileges. But what he noticed in America that he thought was excellent and wanted to praise was that we had these equality of conditions, meaning that people could, through their own will and their own strength and intelligence, be upwardly mobile and enter into politics and participate and contribute. On the other hand, he's also very famous for pointing out that there's a internal tension in democracy. It's the two principles that make up democracy. On the one hand is equality, and on the other hand, freedom. And he believed that they would always be in tension. And his biggest fear was that the fate of freedom in an age of egalitarianism would be rather bleak.
Talking with Dr. Khalil Habib about Tocqueville and democracy in America, his work. Tocqueville's writing a couple of decades before the Civil War, and you alluded to his prediction earlier. What did he write at the time on the debate surrounding the unity of America, meaning we sometimes refer to this as the United States is or the United States are, and also slavery?
Tocqueville was a real critic of slavery of all kinds, but especially the kind practiced in the United States. He calls it totally barbaric. He wants to remind his readers not only of slavery, but also the way in which the early Americans had treated the Native Americans as well. And so toward the very end of the first part, there's a bit of a tragic tone. He seems to want the readers to never forget, one, the Puritans in America, how their austerity produced a certain kind of freedom in their soul that made self-government possible, But he also wanted to remind his readers also of the fate of the Native Americans and also the way in which slavery was practiced. At the time, he felt that the country was, in fact, divided. It couldn't really coexist with two diametrically opposed principles of politics. On the one hand, in the North, there was a sense of genuine equality, mm-hmm. not to be mistaken for egalitarianism, but a real sense that men are born free and equal to others, and that there's no justification for coercing another person or bringing them under your authority. And on the other hand, with the way in which the Southern slave practicing states practiced slavery was diametrically opposed. And sadly, he was right. Such a difference was bound to lead to a civil war, which he predicted. And thankfully, the non-slave states won, and we've abolished slavery as a result.
We'll pause there with Dr. Khalil Habib from Hillsdale College and continue next with more on Alexis de Tocqueville. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Tired of that long drive home from Sacramento? Try Redding Regional Airport, where you can travel the world with one connection on United, Alaska, or Avelo Airlines. RDD is located just down the road. Skip the drive, enjoy quick check-ins, and travel with ease and convenience. Getting where you want to go is easier than ever with nonstop flights to San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, and Burbank. Enjoy that vacation you've been dreaming about. Fly with ease and convenience from Redding Regional Airport.
Just when you thought B&T Satellite only does satellite dishes, it's a fact B&T Satellite makes TV easy. And now Doug's making Starlink Internet easy too. Starlink Internet is often the only way to get connected, especially if you game, stream, or work from home. Most often, there's several devices connected to your internet at one time, and that requires a great internet connection. B&T Satellite is your choice for Starlink Internet, and now Starlink installation and setup. Call B&T Satellite for your internet installation today, 241-3474. You'll always get the best Dish TV and DirecTV packages from B&T Satellite. But did you know Doug can set up your smart home devices, including cameras? Just call Doug at B&T Satellite, 241-3474. Don't call the 800 number. Call B&T Satellite today, 241-3474. For your home custom theater installation, for TV wall mounts, smart home devices, and everything satellite and internet, Doug makes satellite easy. Doug makes internet easy. Doug makes TV easy. Call B&T Satellite, 241-3474.
Welcome to the Queen of Dragons Dispensary, your ultimate destination for top-notch cannabis experiences. Conveniently located at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard, Shasta Lake, our locally owned and operated dispensary takes pride in providing you with the best in price, value, and safety. Rest easy knowing that all of our products are rigorously tested for your peace of mind. We champion medical freedom, empowering you to choose what's right for you. Unbelievable value for unbeatable quality. For exclusive deals and exciting updates, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at the Queen Dragons or visit www.queenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons Dispensary, where the fire of quality meets the freedom of choice. Backed by popular demand, fresh and local flower powered by Pinnacle, Shasta County's premier local cultivator. Package fresh and daily with a wide variety and best prices and deals in town. And they can package larger sizes and quantities on site. Available only at the Queen of Dragons Dispensary. Winter hours are Monday through Sunday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. and they deliver. 530-276-9771.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Sovereign Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, talking with Dr. Khalil Habib from Hillsdale College. He is Associate Professor of Politics, and we're discussing the life, work, and thoughts on America from Alexis de Tocqueville. Now, we've actually talked about this previously on the show a little bit, but since we're talking about Tocqueville and democracy in America, specifically Tocqueville's writing and thoughts on the importance of the freedom of the press and freedom of speech, how do they come through in democracy in America?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite themes, actually, in the book. And what's interesting is, although the book is massive, several, you know, 100 pages, the only topic, to the best of my knowledge, that he devotes two entire chapters to are the freedom of the press. And in order to understand why he was such a freedom of the press absolutist, he wanted zero, and I mean zero, censorship of any kind, is because he saw that the freedom of the press, which is essentially the First Amendment in the United States, mm-hmm. was part and parcel of part of the American tradition of forming associations in which human beings can debate, no matter how nasty things get, the course of their own lives. And that, to him, was the distinguishing feature of what it means to live in a republic. In a republican form of government, human beings have to take ownership and responsibility for their lives and the laws that they pass, because they have to obey the laws, and it's better to obey laws that you had a hand in shaping. His fear with any kind of censorship, and why he thought the freedom of the press was crucial, was he didn't want massive public opinion to erode the individual desires and arguments that we make for how we want to live in our local areas. And so the reason why he wanted a freedom of the press is he wanted to decentralize public opinion as much as possible. He warned against media being dominated by one or two corporate entities. Mm-hmm. He thought that that would be too powerful and would end up shaping public opinion, and the people behind it would essentially be ruling elites.
Dr. Habib, Tocqueville comes, he sees, he observes, he writes. In the end, why does he think that Republican representative democracy succeeds in the U.S. when it has failed in so many other places? What is the difference?
A number of things. The point of comparison for Tocqueville is always the French Revolution, which is from 1789 to 1799. And of course, that's where Tocqueville is from. And there was an experiment to establish some kind of regime founded on reason and equality and freedom, but it was a complete disaster. Part of the reason why he believed that the experiment in liberty failed in France and failed to take root, but managed to succeed remarkably well in the United States, is twofold. On the one hand, he believed that the French did not have the experience in self-government. Once Louis XIV started to centralize authority, people no longer were able to govern their own lives. So you had the centralized government, you had a bureaucratic state that was essentially calling all the shots. And so the revolutionaries, he said, became abstract and violent because they lacked any kind of political common sense. Why? Because they had no experience in governing their affairs anymore. So they were all armchair quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. And so had lost contact with reality. In the United States, by contrast, he says two things made America succeed. One, the American colonists had developed, he says, a habit of freedom, partly because of their Christianity. Because of the austerity of their moral commitments, they were able to govern their own passions and desires. So the first experience in self-rule came by way of moral and religious righteousness. That trickles out into the public space, where then human beings can be trusted to govern their own lives because they live according to moral scruples. The other factor is he believes that the habits of self-government predate Tudor England, and that many of the colonists, in fact, all of the colonists who have come to New England and settle it, had actually come from centuries of developed practices in local self-government. And that is in stark contrast with the French Revolution, where essentially nobody was really governing their own affairs anymore. They were subject to arbitrary decrees that would come from bureaucrats in Versailles that were completely removed from reality and the lived experience of the Frenchmen.
Dr. Habib, you already talked about Tocqueville projecting and predicting the Civil War and who would win and who would lose.
What things does he write about that he gets right? Other things he gets right? Does he get anything wrong about what he saw as the future of the United States?
I think what he gets right is actually quite haunting, and that is he believed that America had many fine institutions that could potentially push back against the tyranny of the majority. And he looks, for example, at the freedom of the press, and now one wonders, do we still have that? And he does predict that these things would require vigilance, but they could easily be lost.
Mm-hmm.
He looks at universities and colleges and says America has quite a few of them, and they can always serve to push back against egalitarianism and public opinion. And then, of course, today you wonder, well, did he accurately predict that those two could potentially be eroded?
Mm-hmm.
So he is aware that we do have institutions, but he's concerned that we would lose them. The one insight that he has that I find a little bit perplexing, and depending on which day you ask me, I would say either got it right or he got it wrong, and that is his psychological analysis of the tyranny of the majority. You can't read Democracy in America without being struck by this terrifying vision that he gives of the future, where a democratic majority could essentially trample on the rights of their own citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have a certain kind of egalitarianism run to such an extreme that the individual liberties of American citizens would be squashed. Now, the reason why I say I'm somewhat perplexed by this is because as I observe American politics today, I don't know whether or not we are living under a tyranny of the majority, or rather a tyranny of ruling elites who manipulate the majority.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subtle difference. And he doesn't, to the best of my knowledge, talk about how maybe a handful of elites can commandeer public opinion by centralizing, say, the media, centralizing, taking over higher education, could then end up using the majority against their own best interests.
Dr. Khalil Habib talking Tocqueville and Democracy in America. I want to ask a two-part question about the book's legacy. What kind of an impact did Democracy in America have upon its release at the time? And then why are we still talking about it today? What are the everlasting lessons that perhaps we keep looking back at in Democracy in America?
Yeah, it was massively successful. He had already had a national reputation in France. The book was sold like hotcakes. Everybody was interested in what was going on in the United States. France had still not really recovered from the consequences of the French Revolution. And then here comes a French diplomat singing the praises of America, which everybody in France really enjoyed looking down upon. Here comes one of their illustrious aristocrats holding it up as an exemplar of democracy in the United States. It remains a classic, I think, because of its comprehensive nature. And again, he also correctly points out that the future doesn't belong to monarchy and it doesn't belong to aristocracy. The future is going to be democratic. The question is, which of those two principles is going to predominate? Is it going to be equality or is it going to be freedom? And is there a way to somehow moderate these two extremes within any democracy and find a way to preserve what is true and what is liberal in classical modern liberalism in a world where democracy and especially egalitarianism seems to be constantly moving in an extreme direction? I think anybody interested in modern sociology or politics has to wrestle with the book and the claims that he makes.
Dr. Khalil Habib, Associate Professor of Politics and Allison and Dorothy Rouse Professor in Politics at Hillsdale College, talking about something near and dear to him, Tocqueville and Democracy in America. Dr. Habib, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Scott, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Up next, we talk with author Tracy Lee Simmons about his recent book, On Being Civilized. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thirty years ago, Simpson University arrived in Reading with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Hello, Northern California. This is Rollin from the Flag Center. Winter rain and wind is hard on flags. So until March 21st, bring us that tattered old glory and we'll give you 15% off any all-weather Tuftex American flag. Stop in and see us at 2124 Hilltop Drive or on the web at theflagcenter.com. The Flag Center, since 1982. American flags, American made.
Hi friends, RC here, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor, the Diesel Vintage. A smooth burn, a perfect draw, and flavor for days. This is what an expertly crafted parejo from the farms of A.J. Fernandez offers us. The Diesel Vintage is everything we seek in a fine and exceptional cigar experience. Get yours today at Tobacco & Brew, Redding, California.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
Hi, this is Linda Fott. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, for North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
This is Elle. Join me and my good friend and co-host Ron Lim and Lenny Matthews for our show Ask Elle right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. we'll be exploring powerful topics on how to have a successful and satisfying relationship. See you here on Tuesday night at 6 p.m. brought to you by KNS Staffing Solutions.
530-605-4517.
Join Token's radio show every Sunday at 2 p.m. on 96.5 FM and AM 1460 as host Christy Matthews and Linda Kent explore the exciting world of cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. Learn how Bitcoin is revolutionizing finance and grasp sound money principles. Hear new perspectives on achieving financial freedom beyond broken institutions. The future of money is here. Empower yourself with knowledge. Listen to Token's radio show with Linda and Christy this Sunday at 2 p.m. on KCNR. Big and exciting changes are underway.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network for older episodes of this program plus other great Hillsdale audio. It's at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Tracy Lee Simmons, a writer and journalist. His latest book is On Being Civilized, A Few Lines Amid the Breakage. You can find that at Amazon or at memoriapress.com. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The title of the book, On Being Civilized, I think demands a definition. So let's start there. What would you say it means to be civilized?
Well, that's the propitious question of the moment, isn't it? At one time, the idea of civilization was simply an honorific. It's what everyone aspired to. It's what everyone considered terrestrial success. Now we're in a generation of people who are not sure that civilization is a particularly good thing. So the work I've done in literary journalism has been to try to place the civilized ideal before us all, and I've done this through essays, articles, and principally book reviews, really, trying to forward this conversation about what it means to be civilized and what does it mean. There are as many definitions as there are stars in the sky, I suppose. But to be formed, I think, spiritually as well as politically, to have ideals that transcend the self and to live by them, and of course to live corporately. Civilization suggests the idea of citizen, and citizens live together in a particular way, but that has to start with the individual. So people have to be individually civilized before they can be corporately so.
Why is it so important that we talk about this, that we think about being civilized? Why write a book called On Being Civilized?
As I said, because we're going through a period when that is not an obvious thing to aspire to anymore. But life has always been better under those societies that were more civilized than others, when all of the cylinders were firing, educationally, materially, economically, artistically, religiously, socially, all of those things that need to be addressed in some way in each civilized epoch. And of course, ideals of what constitutes civilization are going to differ from one period to another, perhaps, but there's going to be lots of overlap. We consider the way we treat one another to be sort of the benchmark of civilized life, of civilized behavior. When you're supposed to act civilized, that's not simply a matter of whom you vote for.
On Being Civilized is the book by Tracy Lee Simmons. Inside the book, you discuss how it's easier to identify civilization once you've seen it than it is to simply define it. Why is that the case?
Because it's kaleidoscopic, really. There are too many aspects to it. We could talk all day about political civilization or economic civilization or social civilization. But those are only divided for purposes of analysis. Mainly, we're talking about a society that has to be working on and by all of those ideals. And so it's hard to define a civilization, but as someone once said of something else, you know it when you see it. Well, we know it when we see it, but there are too many people who are no longer really seeing it or no longer really aspiring to it. When you have a culture of people, for instance, who are concerned more about what they're getting than what they're giving, you're in a delicate moment for any civilization when everyone's out for himself. If you take that path too far, you're living in barbarism.
In the book, you list a number of signposts of a civilized life. Which do you think are most indicative of a civilized person or a civilized society?
Well, that list came from a talk I gave, and there's a more than a little bit of jocularity and tongue-in-cheek in some of those ideas. But whimsical as it may be, there's a serious purpose there. My idea was to say, we know we're living in a civilized era when, and I just put down a list. And one of the signposts was the belief that people are improvable but not perfectible. I think that's a fault line in current thinking. Most people who we would consider associated with the right, say, would say that people are improvable, but people more on the left want to say that we are perfectible. Living by either ideal is going to have a profound effect on behavior, and the ideals as you practice them. The old classical ideal is that we are not perfectible as human beings. Certainly the Judeo-Christian idea holds that we are not perfectible, but we are improvable. And to the extent that human beings are improvable, society is improvable too.
Tracy Lee Simmons is with us. His book On Being Civilized, A Few Lines Amid the Breakage. Do you think that Western civilization is dying or just evolving into perhaps something else?
Well, it's endangered, I think. And in the worst way, a civilization can be endangered from within. We can go down the list. Academia or higher academia has turned poisonous. There's no news there, but it's only been recognized within the last 5 or 10 years by people who were not aware of such trends before. When you are instructing young people badly, or you are giving them not so much teaching but propaganda, you're putting your civilization at risk, as we've seen within the last several months. College campuses are full of people who not only cannot think, but they're not expected to think. But they're expected to simply shout cliches. And that is not the old, that is not the idea of the college mind. The college mind is supposed to be independent, dedicated, certainly, but someone who is capable of independent thought. And that is not what we see. And of course, in the arts and in advertising, you know, across the board, Western civilization certainly has its back to the barricades at this point, because there are people who truly want to destroy it, and say so. 20 years ago, they weren't saying so; they simply lived by that intention. Now they're coming out and saying so. So it seems to me that in whatever capacity we as individuals have, those of us who love our civilization, love the in America, love the country that came from Western civilization, should stand up for it in the way other people are trying to tear it down. And so this book was an effort to put together a lot of essays and reviews and so forth that have some sort of bearing on the topic of civilization. And because it was all essentially journalism, it's not academic writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's written for a wider audience.
You allude to the fact that a good number of the chapters in this book are in the form of book reviews, which in a way has become a lost art. What do you think makes for a good book review, and what role do they play in leading and living a civilized life?
A smaller and smaller part all the time. When I was at National Review, Bill Buckley used to say that book reviews are the easiest form to do badly and the hardest to do well. So that might be the beginning of some sort of an explanation. I think of book reviews as occasions for thinking and reflection. And it's also a kind of, you're a kind of first responder to a book that's come out that the author hopes and the publisher hopes that everyone is or many, many people are going to see. And the reviewer has this kind of midwife function of trying to bring that book into the world and give people a reason to read that book, or perhaps a reason not to read the book. But I tend to be one who likes to review positively. But of course, when you're assigned books in another period of my life, which I was, I couldn't always be as positive as I was later.
Tracy Lee Simmons, his recent book, On Being Civilized, A Few Lines Amid the Breakage. You can find it at Amazon or at memoriapress.com. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Delighted. Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Dr. Andrew Russell from Hillsdale's Biology Department about biofilm research. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hey, listeners, when it comes to romance, what's more romantic than two forks sharing one creamy, delicious piece of cheesecake? Drizzle that cheesecake with Nutella, the irresistible and beloved cocoa hazelnut spread, and you've got a shareable sweetheart of a dessert to finish off your Black Bear Diner meal. So grab your Valentine and make your way to Black Bear Diner for a cozy and shareable celebration. Order online at blackbeardiner.com or stop by daily at our Reading location.
Black Bear Diner.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel has a full-service organization with departments staffed with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is Susan Eastman, financial advisor, Stifel Nicolaus. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Give me a call at 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month starting at 8 a.m. for the Gorman Law Hour featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Find the show on Facebook, search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, and get updates each week on new shows. We're joined by Dr. Andrew Russell. He is Associate Professor of Biology at Hillsdale College. Dr. Russell, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Discussing today your work research into biofilms, which means we need to talk about what that is first. Biofilms, what are they? How do they form?
Yeah, so as a biologist, I'm studying different microorganisms, and essentially you can think of a biofilm as a community of bacterial cells growing together. And usually that means sticking to a surface. So that's the simple definition, but understanding the complexities of how they form is kind of where this area of research is concentrated on.
So what's the problem with biofilms? And I guess on the flip side, are there occasions when it's actually beneficial that biofilms are forming somewhere?
Yeah, so the issues arise depending on the various fields. The most prominent issues come in the medical field. So biofilms can be formed via a variety of different bacterial cells, and including many pathogenic or what we call disease-forming or disease-causing bacteria. And the issues arise then if this certain type of bacteria then is growing on you or inside of you when you get an implant or something, that can then result in a disease that's really hard to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the issue in the medical field, is that besides giving them the ability to stick to surfaces, this communal biofilm also is very resistant to treatments like antimicrobial compounds and antibiotics.
But today, we're not talking about the medical field. You've done research in a few areas, and today we're focused on beer tubing. Not real close to medical, but I know the research can apply in various areas.
Mm-hmm.
So this research on biofilms in various types of beer tubing, what inspired you to pursue this question?
Well, this was earlier in my career. I had been working at a previous institution in South Dakota called Northern State University, and I was involved in undergraduate research there. And I had a student who approached me as a freshman and wanted to get involved in my lab. And so I was looking at different projects that he could be involved in. And I stumbled upon some research that some colleagues of mine were working on at Montana State University, which is they have an institute for biofilm research. And they had been doing some research on biofilms in breweries and things. So at the time, I was also talking with a student about my newfound interest in brewing, like home brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, interested in that. And so I decided to pitch this idea to him, like, hey, there's not a lot of research done on biofilms in the brewing industry. So why don't we try to figure out a project that you can do? And he was definitely interested. And so we started looking into various issues and discovered that there were a lot of biofilms that grow just simply in the draft lines from a keg to a dispense system in, you know, a bar or restaurant. And, you know, the ways of treating this issue are pretty rudimentary still. Mm-hmm. And there had been some companies that had come up with different types of tubing that promised the ability to resist biofilm formation, but nobody had actually done a peer-reviewed study on that. So that was what kind of instigated our initial interest in the topic and why we developed a project for it.
Talking with Dr. Andrew Russell from the biology department here at Hillsdale. So what exactly did you test and what did you find out?
Yeah, so we come to find out that there's several different types of tubing that a bar or a restaurant can use in dispensary systems. There's the old classic nylon, or there's polypropylene tubing. Mm-hmm. There's also vinyl tubing, which is your most common form. And then there's some others that are blends and proprietary mixtures from various companies. So we decided to compare these tubings and chose three different types. And so we needed to figure out a way to, like, mimic a bar scenario.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of devised, with the help of a local brewery called the Dakota Territory Brewing Company there in Aberdeen, South Dakota. They provided for us beer and kegs, and we, you know, they gave us one of their famous amber ales to test this on. And they also gave us essentially a large kegerator that they would use to take to venues, and told us how to set up the system. So essentially we hooked up these three different tubing types all to the same keg of beer, and then we tainted the system by creating a microbial cocktail, as I like to call it. So we looked through the literature, we found out what are the most common species of bacteria that cause contamination in breweries. So we chose two of those, and then we also chose a species of yeast that's used for brewing. Because a lot of these biofilms that you find in the wild, so to speak, are what we call multi-species biofilms. Mm-hmm. It's not just one type of bacterial species that's growing. It's a collection of different types that all collaborate together to stick. So we chose three of them, and I mixed them up, cultured them together, and then just saturated this system with it to allow time for these bacterial cells and yeast cells to stick to the tubing. Then we rinsed it out with water and everything, and then we added the beer, and then we just randomly would dispense a certain amount of beer through the system, and we did this for about 3 months without doing anything to it. We changed the tanks for it, but that's about it. We wouldn't clean it or anything. And then after the period of 3 months, then we just tested to see which of these three tubings had biofilm forming in them, and did any of them resist biofilm formation. And what we found was that just as the manufacturer promised, there was this one type of tubing that really was resistant against biofilm formation. So it comes to find out that it has a special nylon barrier in it. And this essentially seems to be preventing biofilm formation by creating an oxygen barrier.
Mm-hmm.
Because these microbes, like most living organisms, need oxygen to survive. So the more you can prevent oxygen from leaking into those tubes, the better you can prevent the formation of biofilms.
So is that nylon tubing, nylon barrier tubing, in wide use at this point? And what does it mean? What should it mean, perhaps, for big brewers and for small brewers alike?
Yeah, at the time that we did the study, it wasn't very widely adopted. It was kind of a new proprietary form of tubing. Still, if you go to most restaurants, bars, they still use classic vinyl tubing, which is fine. But believe it or not, it actually has a lot of oxygen that penetrates it when it's just sitting there. We tend to think of these plastic tubings as being impenetrable by oxygen and other gases, but they're not. They have gaps in them and oxygen can get in. So this new type of tubing wasn't in wide circulation. I'm not exactly sure how much it's been adopted now.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is it's slowly being adopted as people realize the benefits of it. Because beyond just keeping things clean, they actually allow people to not have to clean stuff as often. Because if you use old vinyl tubing, you're supposed to clean it essentially, I think, once a week, really thoroughly, which is very time consuming.
Dr. Andrew Russell, final question. Applications for this type of research, I imagine, you know, for Pop and Pepsi and Coke,
yeah,
they can use this information. But we kind of started by talking about medicine. Mm-hmm. Can this sort of research be transferred into that world as well?
Yeah, I mean, you think of any time that you're moving one fluid from one space to another, you're going to be using tubing. So this type of nylon barrier tubing can actually be very beneficial for that. So that's not just breweries or bars or dispensaries, but it's also, yeah, you go to the local Dairy Queen or whatever, and they have a pop machine there. Biofilms can grow in the tubing of those soda lines, even the water lines in your own home can actually have biofilms growing on them. So incorporating this type of nylon barrier tubing is good for that reason. But we can even go beyond that, because anytime you can make a surface that you want to keep clean, mm-hmm. and that surface can be made out of some sort of plastic material, this is a great option for that. Or if you think of various types of consumer goods that you have in plastic containers, if you want to increase the shelf life and you can, you know, spend a couple of extra cents on that product's packaging, then it's going to increase the life of that product quite a bit.
Dr. Andrew Russell, Associate Professor of Biology here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Russell, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks so much.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Khalil Habib from Hillsdale's Politics Department, Tracy Lee Simmons, his new book on being civilized, and Andrew Russell from Hillsdale's Biology Department. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. The assistant producer of the program is Sam Lair. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Just when you thought B&T Satellite only does satellite dishes, it's a fact. B&T Satellite makes TV easy. And now Doug's making Starlink Internet easy, too. Starlink Internet is often the only way to get connected, especially if you game, stream, or work from home. Most often, there's several devices connected to your Internet at one time, and that requires a great Internet connection. B&T Satellite is your choice for Starlink Internet, and now Starlink installation and setup. Call B&T Satellite for your Internet installation today, 241-3474. You'll always get the best Dish TV and DirecTV packages from B&T Satellite. But did you know Doug can set up your smart home devices, including cameras? Just call Doug at B&T Satellite, 241-3474. Don't call the 800 number. Call B&T Satellite today, 241-3474. For your home custom theater installation, for TV wall mounts, smart home devices, and everything satellite and internet, Doug makes satellite easy. Doug makes internet easy. Doug makes TV easy. Call B&T Satellite, 241-3474.
Welcome to the Queen of Dragons Dispensary, your ultimate destination for top-notch cannabis experiences. Conveniently located at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard, Shasta Lake, our locally owned and operated dispensary takes pride in providing you with the best in price, value, and safety. Rest easy knowing that all of our products are rigorously tested for your peace of mind. We champion medical freedom, empowering you to choose what's right for you. Unbelievable value for unbeatable quality. For exclusive deals and exciting updates, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at the Queen Dragons or visit www.queenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons Dispensary, where the fire of quality meets the freedom of choice.
Backed by popular demand, fresh and local flower powered by Pinnacle, Shasta County's premier local cultivator. Package fresh and daily with a wide variety and best prices and deals in town. And they can package larger sizes and quantities on site. Available only at the Queen of Dragons Dispensary. Winter hours are Monday through Sunday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. and they deliver. 530-276-9771.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.